The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. For our first article today, it's from the technology section, and it's called The Death of the Minivan by Ian Bogost. The minivan dilemma. It is the least cool vehicle ever designed, yet the most useful, offering the best value for the most function to a plurality of American drivers. A minivan can cart 7 passengers or more in comfort, if not style, haul more cargo than many larger trucks, and do so for a sticker price roughly a quarter cheaper than competing options. Even so, minivan sales have been falling steadily since their peak in 2000, when about 1.3 million were sold in the United States. As of last year, that figure is down by about 80%. Once sold in models from more than a dozen manufacturers, the minivan market it now amounts to 4, one each from Chrysler, Toyota, Honda, and Kia. Excuse me. On account of the dilemma, a minivan is typically purchased under duress. If you live in a driving city, and especially if you have a family, a minivan conversation will eventually take place. Your older, cooler car, perhaps your Mini Cooper or your spouse's Honda CR-V, will prove unfit for present purposes. Costco cargo, loads of mulch, sports equipment, and holiday loot all need a place to go. The same is true of car seats, which now are recommended for children as old as 7. And so, before too long, maybe we should get a minivan. This phrase is uttered with an air of resignation. The minivan was popular, but it was never cool, not even in its youth during the 1980s. Now it's middle-aged. The first of its type came out in 1983, which makes the minivan an elder millennial. It's no more attuned than your average 41-year-old to recent trends. But why exactly has it earned so much derision through the years? And why was the minivan replaced almost altogether by the SUV? The minivan arrived, way back when, as a savior. When Chrysler, under the former Ford chief Lee Iacocca's direction, first conceived of the design in the late 1970s, Americans who wanted room to cart more kids and goods had only a couple of options. One was the land yacht-style station wagon, perhaps in avocado green with faux wood paneling. Lots of kids could pile onto its bench and jump seats, while the rear storage, accessible by hatch, allowed for easy loading. These cars were somewhat functional, but they didn't seem that safe. The suburban family's other choice was a full-size van, a big, boxy transport or utility vehicle. The gas for these was also pricey, and their aesthetic felt unsuited to domesticity. By cultural consensus, vans were made for plumbers, kidnappers, or ex-special forces domestic mercenaries. Chrysler's minivan would steer clear of those two dead ends and carry American families onto the open roads toward, well, youth soccer and mall commerce. It really did bring innovation, ample seating organized in rows with easy access, the ability to stow those seats in favor of a large cargo bay, a set of sliding doors, and smaller features that had not been seen before, such as the modern cup holder. And it offered all that at an affordable price with decent fuel economy. Pickup was quick. In the first year after introducing them, Chrysler sold 210,000 Dodge Caravans and Plymouth Voyagers in its initial two models. Overall, minivan sales reached 700,000 by the end of the decade, as the station wagon all but disappeared. But the new design also generated stigma, As the child of the station wagon and the service van, the minivan quickly came to represent the family you love but must support, and also transport. In a nation where cars stood in for power and freedom, the minivan would mean the opposite. As a vehicle, it symbolized the burdens of domestic life. That stigma only grew with time. In 1996, Automobile Magazine called this backlash somewhat understandable, given that the members of my generation, who were at that point young adults, had spent their youth strapped into the back seat of one. Perhaps it was childhood itself that seemed uncool, rather than the car that facilitated it. In any case, minivans would soon be obsolesced by sports utility vehicles. The earliest SUVs were more imposing than they are today. Hard-riding trucks with 4x4 capabilities, such as the Chevrolet Suburban and the Jeep Wrangler. These were as big or even bigger than the plumber kidnapper vans of the 1970s, and they got terrible gas mileage, cost a lot of money, and were hard to get in and out of, especially if you were very young or even slightly old. Yet the minivan's identity had grown toxic, and for suburban parents, the SUV played into the fantasy of being somewhere else or doing something better. The SUV's promise was escape from the very sort of family life that the minivan had facilitated. In 2003, New York Times' John Tierney recounted how the new class of vehicles had taken over. Quote, "The minivan became so indelibly associated with suburbia that even soccer moms shunned it," end quote, he explained. Soon, image-conscious parents were going to soccer games in vehicles designed to ford Yukon streams and invade Middle Eastern countries. At the same time, the SUVs themselves were changing. The minivan had been built from parts and designs for a car, not a van. SUV manufacturers followed suit until their vehicles were no longer burly trucks so much as car-like vehicles that rode higher off the ground and had a station wagon-style cargo bay. Few even had more seats than a sedan. As the early minivans were to vans, so these downsized SUVs to the 4x4s that came before them. Functionally, the minivan is still the better option. It is cheaper to buy and operate, with greater cargo space and more seating and headroom. Still, these benefits are overshadowed by the minivan's dreary semiotics. Manufacturers have tried to solve that problem. When my family reached the maybe we should get a minivan milestone, I noticed that some models of the Chrysler Pacifica now offered, for a premium, blacked-out chrome grille and rims. But to buy a poser sports van, or whatever I was meant to call this try-hard, cooler version of the uncool minivan, struck me as an even sadder choice. Beyond such minor mods, the industry hasn't really done that much to shake away the shame from the minivan's design. I suspect that any fix would have to be applied at the level of its DNA. The minivan was the offspring of a wagon and a van. To be reborn, another pairing must occur. But with what? Little differentiation is left in the passenger vehicle market. Nearly all cars have adopted the SUV format, a shoe-shaped body with four swinging doors and a hatch, and the true 4x4s have been all but abandoned. Perhaps the minivan could be recrossed with the boxy utility van, which seems ready for its own revival. This year, Volkswagen will begin selling a new electric version of its microbus, one of the few direct precursors to the minivan that managed to retain an association with the counterculture, despite taking on domestic functions. However it evolves, the minivan will still be trammeled by its fundamental purpose. It is useful because it offers benefits for families, and it is uncool because family life is thought to be imprisoning. That logic cannot be overcome by mere design. In the end, the minivan dilemma has more to do with how Americans think than what we drive. Families, or at least vehicles expressly designed for them, turned out to be lamentable. We prefer to daydream about fording Yukon streams instead. Our second article, Lighthouse Parents Have More Confident Kids, by Russell Shaw. When my son was a toddler, he liked to run in our driveway until he fell. He would then turn to me to see if he was hurt. If my face betrayed worry, or if I audibly gasped, he would wail. If I maintained equanimity, he would brush himself off and get back to running. Learning that I could so powerfully influence his mental state was a revelation. Here was the human being who was counting on me to make sense of his world, not just how to tie his shoes or recite the ABCs, but how to feel. Years later, when he was in middle school, this lesson came back to me. One night while doing homework, my son told me about a classmate who had been unkind to him. My first instinct was to rush to fix it, email the parents, call the school, demand action. But instead of reacting, I paused. "That sounds hard. What did you do?" "I decided not to hang out with him for a while," my son replied. "I'm going to try playing soccer at lunch instead." "That's a great solution," I said, and he went back to his homework. These otherwise ordinary parenting moments crystallized for me an important truth. Sometimes the best thing a parent can do is nothing at all. Parents of any age can conjure up the feeling they had when they first held their child and thought, "Oh, here you are, this person whom I'm in charge of." And they can tell you that no single piece of parenting wisdom can prepare you for this new, magical, terrifying endeavor. Parenting is joyous and challenging and sometimes stressful. In fact, a recent advisory from the Surgeon General argues that parenting is hazardous to people's mental health. The report cites a range of factors that are contributing to the perilous parental landscape, from the complexities of social media to worries about children's safety. It goes on to propose an array of solutions, including investments in child care and federal paid family leave. There's no question that many American parents desperately need more support. Yet the Surgeon General is missing one important strategy that is within control of every parent: a look in the mirror. What if the ways in which we are parenting are making life harder on our kids and harder on us? What if by doing less, parents would foster better outcomes for children and parents alike? I've spent the past 30 years working in schools, and I've watched thousands of parents engage with educators and with their children. Too often I watch parents over-functioning, depriving their kids of the confidence that comes from struggling and persevering, and exhausting themselves in the process. Although this has been true throughout my career, it's growing more acute. Most Americans now believe that young people will not be better off than their parents. They see greater competition for fewer resources, be it college admissions, jobs, or housing. Parents are scrambling to ensure that their kids are the ones who will be able to get ahead. We're biologically wired to prevent our children suffering, and it can be excruciating to watch them struggle. A parent's first instinct is often to remove obstacles from the child's path, obstacles that feel overwhelming to them, but are easily navigable by us. This urge has led to pop culture mythology around pushy parenting styles, including the helicopter parent who flies in to rescue the child, and the snowplow parent who flattens any obstacle in their child's way. A young person who grows accustomed to having a parent intervene on his behalf begins to believe he's not capable of acting on his own. I want to make a case for the lighthouse parent. A lighthouse parent stands as a steady, reliable guide, providing safety and clarity without controlling every aspect of their child's journey. Here's an example. A child comes home feeling overwhelmed by school and frustrated that she is doing all of the work for a big group project that is due next week. The overfunctioning parent is ready with an array of next steps. "Why don't you assign the other group members what they each have to do? You should put your name next to all of the parts that you did so the teacher gives you credit. I'm going to email the teacher so she knows that you're doing all the work." These tactics may address symptoms, but they fail to get at the underlying issue. They also inadvertently communicate to a child that what's needed is parental involvement. Sometimes what a child needs is simply to be acknowledged. Wow, that sounds like a lot. Like a lighthouse that helps sailors avoid crashing into rocks, lighthouse parents provide firm boundaries and emotional support while allowing their children the freedom to navigate their own challenges. They demonstrate that they trust their kids to handle difficult situations independently. The key is learning when to step back and let them find their own way. One of the most important shifts that parents can make is learning to substitute our impulse to fix problems with the patience to listen. A fix-it mindset is focused on quick solutions. At quelling or containing emotions or discomfort, listening is about allowing emotions to exist without rushing to solve a problem. Listening teaches resilience. It communicates confidence in your child's ability to cope with challenges, however messy they may be. As children grow, parents must move from the role of boss to that of consultant. If children never have the opportunity to stand on their own, we risk setting them up for collapse later on. An aversion to owning mistakes can be the most visible when it comes to student discipline. Adolescents cross boundaries. This is part of growing up. When they do, they receive feedback on their transgression and ideally internalize that feedback, ultimately making the desired values their own. When a teenager plagiarizes a paper or arrives at a school dance under the influence, one part of a school's response is disciplinary. It's a way of providing feedback. In the moment, students don't thank us for administering a consequence. I have yet to hear a student who has been suspended say, "Thank you for helping me learn a lesson that will serve me well in college and beyond." Instead, they say, "This is unfair." Or, "Other kids are doing it too." This is when parents need to stand shoulder to shoulder with the school, communicating a clear and aligned message to support their child's growth. In the 1960s, psychologist Diana Baumrind described three parenting styles, which researchers building on her work eventually expanded to four: authoritarian, permissive, uninvolved, and authoritative. Authoritarian parents make all decisions for their children with little room for negotiation. Permissive parents avoid conflict by setting few boundaries, often leading their children to struggle with discipline and focus. Uninvolved parents are disconnected, providing minimal support or structure. Authoritative parents allow for some flexibility, combining clear expectations with the willingness to listen. Authoritative parents are lighthouse parents. They are clear on values, but open to a range of ways in which these values can be put into practice. They balance structure and authority. The research shows that authoritative parenting yields the best outcome for kids and tend to produce happy and competent adults. All parents show up as authoritarian, permissive, uninvolved, or authoritative at different times, depending on the situation and on what's unfolding in their own lives. But remembering to put parenting in perspective, focusing on long-term outcomes over short-term saves, can reduce some of the stress of parenting while also yielding better outcomes for children. Yes, parenting can be stressful, but when we trust our children to navigate their own course, with us as steady and supportive guides, we lighten our own load and empower them to thrive. Next, a health article. "Everything I Thought I Knew About Nasal Congestion Is Wrong," by Sarah Zhang. Having caught a cold every month since my kids started daycare, I devoted a lot of time recently to the indignity of unclogging my nose. I'm blowing always. I have also struck up an intimate acquaintance with Metipots and a great variety of decongestants. On sleepless nights, I've spent hours turning side to side, trying to clear one nostril and then the other. Nasal congestion, I learned in all this, is far weirder than I ever thought. For starters, the nose is actually two noses, which work in an alternating cycle that is somehow connected to our armpits. The argument that humans have two noses was first put to me by Ronald Eccles, a nose expert who runs the Common Cold Center at Cardiff University in Wales, until his retirement a few years ago. This sounds absurd, I know, but consider what your nose, or noses, looks like on the inside. Each nostril opens into its own nasal cavity, which does not connect with the other directly. They are two separate organs, or as separate as your two eyes or your two ears. And far from being a passive tube, the nose's hidden inner anatomy is constantly changing. It's lined with venous erectile tissue that has a similar structure to the erectile tissue of the penis, Eccles said, and can become engorged with blood. Infection or allergies amplify the swelling, so much so that the nasal passages become completely blocked. This swelling, not mucus, is the primary cause of a stuffy nose, which is why expelling snot never quite fixes congestion entirely. You can blow your nose until the cows come home, and you're not blowing that swollen tissue out, says Timothy Smith, an otolaryngologist at the Oregon Health and Science University's Sinus Center. Gently blowing your nose works fine for any mucus that may be adding to the stuffiness, he told me, but decongestants such as Sudafed and Afrin work by causing blood vessels in the nose to shrink, opening the nasal passages for temporary relief. In healthy noses, the swelling and unswelling of nasal tissue actually follows a predictable pattern called the nasal cycle. Every few hours, one side of the nose becomes partially congested while the other opens. Then they switch, going back and forth, back and forth. The exact pattern and duration vary from person to person, but we rarely notice these changes inside our noses. When I tell people about the nasal cycle, most people are not aware of it at all, says Guillermo Garcia, a biomedical engineer at the Medical College of Wisconsin. I certainly wasn't, and I have been breathing through my nose only my entire life. But the idea made sense as soon as I consciously thought about it. When I'm sick and extra swelling has turned partial congestion into complete congestion, I do tend to feel more blocked on one side than the other. Once you're aware of the nasal cycle, you can control it to some extent. In fact, when I was turning from side to side during my sleepless nights, I was unknowingly activating receptors under my arm, which open the opposite side of the nose. This could be an age-old survival reflex. When we lie down on our right side, our left nostril is further from the ground and less likely obstructed. Yogis have learned to take advantage of this using a small crutch under the arm called a yoga danda to direct breathing to one nostril or the other. And an online hack for stuffy noses suggests squeezing a bottle under the opposite arm. The effect is not instantaneous, though. When I tried this recently, my arm got tired before my nose unclogged. And when I tried again with an old crutch that I had from a knee injury, it took several minutes, by which time I'd already reached for a tissue out of impatience and habit. No one knows exactly why humans have a nasal cycle, but cats, pigs, rabbits, dogs, and rats all have one too, according to Eccles. One hypothesis proposes that this cycle helps guard against pathogens. When the venous erectile tissue shrinks, antibody-rich plasma is squeezed out into the inner lining of the nose. Each cycle might replenish the nose's defense. Eccles also pointed out that upper respiratory viruses seem to prefer temperatures just below body temperature. When one side of the nose becomes partially congested, it might warm up enough to ward off viruses. Or, he said, the cycle allows one half of the nose to rest at a time. Unlike our eyes, ears, and mouths, noses have to function 24 hours a day, every day, constantly filtering and warming air for this delicate tissue of our lungs. The nose's job might not sound that hard, but consider what it has to do. The air we breathe is maybe 70 degrees Fahrenheit and 35% humidity, Smith said. By the time the air goes in my nose and gets back into my nasal pharynx, which is, what, maybe 3 to 4 inches, it is 98.7 degrees Fahrenheit and 100% humidity. The nose is quite the powerful little HVAC system. But it's fallible, too. Our noses don't measure airflow directly. Instead, they rely on cold receptors that are activated when cool air passes by. These cold receptors can be tricked by, say, menthol. Eccles has found that people given menthol lozenges can hold their breath longer, possibly because the minty coolness fools them into thinking they are still getting air. And that's why Vicks VapoRub might make congestion feel better, despite having no positive effect on the opening of the nasal passages. The opposite may happen in a baffling condition called empty nose syndrome, in which a very small proportion of patients who have surgery to improve airflow in their noses end up feeling completely clogged, possibly because of damage to cold receptors and other changes in sensation. The lack of a feeling of airflow can be so disturbing that these patients feel like they're suffocating, even though their noses are perfectly unobstructed. To a lesser extent, we are all unreliable narrators of our nasal congestion. When patients go to be examined, a doctor might see that one side of their nose is clearly more swollen than the other, but it's not necessarily the same side that the patient feels is more congested. This still baffles clinicians, Smith told me. Other factors such as temperature must play a role. The inner workings of the nose are complicated and still mysterious. I'll be thinking about all this the next time I'm lying awake at night, once again sick, once again congested. Since I have a spare moment, I wanted to share with you that the music you hear with my Atlantic Magazine episodes is from the song Echoes. This is from the album Breathless, the sixth album by the English progressive rock band Camel. This was released in 1978. And is obviously a favorite of mine. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Have a great day.